Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
We are back. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. I'm Tim Reedy, along with Father Matt Malone, and we are talking with former U.S. Senator George Mitchell about his new memoir, The Negotiator. Now, Senator Mitchell, we've been talking about your years in Maine growing up, the faith life that your parents imparted to you. How did those values inform your negotiating, which, you know, of course, the title of the book here, in terms of your work in Northern Ireland and also in the Senate?
Well, I think it was a factor in an indirect sense, certainly. My mother lived in the belief that every person was a good person until they demonstrated very clearly that they weren't. In other words, she gave everybody the benefit of the doubt and thought everyone had the same attitude that she did. It involved respect for others, respect for differences, while also maintaining good relationships. I tell an anecdote in my book about when I was a young boy, we lived in a sort of a slum area, mostly immigrants, many from Lebanon, many French-Canadian from Quebec, and a couple of young men who were Mormons came to live in that area for a year as part of the mission of their faith. They had absolutely no luck. Everybody in our area was a devout Catholic, and they didn't, I don't think they made a single convert. But my mother liked them, kind of felt bad for them, so invited them in for a meal, and then they came, and then they started eating regularly because they weren't having success elsewhere, and although she didn't pay any attention to their conversion efforts, she fed them, and they had a good time, and she liked and respected them. That was my first experience with the Mormons, and I admired them for the fact that they were willing to undertake this this mission. So I think it involves respect for others, listening to other points of view, trying to understand why people act as they do, all of which contributes, I think, to the kind of skills you need to succeed in negotiations.
And there was one of the stories that I really liked in the book involved the first thing that you did after you became majority leader in reaching out to the other side. And I wonder if you could let our listeners in on that story and how these kind of simple values and promises played out.
Yes, I'm a Democrat. I was elected by the Democrats who were in the majority in the Senate at the time. And shortly after I was elected, on the same day, I called Bob Dole, one of the first calls I made. He then was the Republican leader in the Senate. And I asked if I could come to see him. He said, of course. And I walked down around the corner in the Capitol to his office. And I told him that he'd been there many years. I was fairly new. I'd only been there a few years. And he knew a lot more than I did. But I knew enough to know that these were tough jobs. And if the leaders didn't trust one another, they'd become impossible. And so I said to him, I'm here to tell you how I intend to behave toward you and ask you to behave toward me in the same way. And I set forth the most basic, simple standards of fairness, openness, fair dealing, and courtesy. He was thrilled. He was delighted. We shook hands. And to this very moment, although we disagreed politically almost every day on most bills, to this very moment, never has a harsh word ever passed between Bob Dole and me in public or in private.
Yeah. And is that kind of trust something that we need to recover in our national politics today, do you think?
Yes, I think it would go a long way toward relieving the dysfunction that exists, although I think there are many factors. The extent of money in politics is a huge one. The extent to which gerrymandering has become very precise and extremely hyper-partisan. A whole range of factors. I don't think trust can be restored just by people saying we trust you. I think it'll take a lot more over time and an aroused public, and we haven't seen that yet.
And it also seems to me that there are more ways to say things and more opportunities to say things that for good or ill through the advent of, you know, mass communications and social media and all the rest. And there's a way in which that helps the conversation. There's a way in which it kind of impoverishes it.
Well, I think the net effect probably has been negative in debasing the discourse in our country. And I think that all traces, it's part of the same issue as money. Campaigns in America have always been rough. Politics has always been tough. There's never been a time when it was all sweetness and light. Just a year ago, a professor at the University of Maine wrote a lengthy article on the presidential campaign of 1800. The candidates were two men who've become national icons. Thomas Jefferson was the challenger. John Adams was the incumbent. And the things that they and their supporters said about the other were awful, far worse than anything Romney and Obama said in the last election. But that those words were written. They were spoken to small audiences. They were read by only a few people. They didn't have the power and the overwhelming ubiquity that modern electronic communications, particularly television, the advent of the 30-second negative attack spot. And so now, because of this tremendous billions of dollars going in, the cost of television, this dominates campaigns. What has all the talk been about in the last month, 2 months, in the Republican presidential campaign is the debate that's coming up tomorrow.
Right.
It's a televised debate.
Right, right. And it didn't, it also, in that election that you referred to in 1800, it didn't prevent Jefferson and Adams from having a lasting friendship in the end.
That's right. That's absolutely right. After the battle was over.
Right. Exactly. And that's a, you know, the other thing that struck me in reading your memoir was, gosh, you know, if people can overcome in such a profound way divisions in Northern Ireland that have such a history and all the rest and, you know, fraught with tragedy, if people can begin to overcome a similar history in the Middle East, you know, why can't we who share the same politics and the same national values, you know, overcome our rather petty differences by comparison?
Yeah, we should be able to, really. And the fact is, you don't. Unfortunately, in our country today, in our politics, any form of compromise is seen as a weakness. It is seen as a giving up of your principles or a departure from truth. Reality is, of course, this is a country of 320 million people, tremendously diverse, people from all over the world, sectional, regional, all kinds of differences. The notion that this country can be governed without compromise is, of course, a fantasy. So you have to be able to figure out how people can have the freedom and the flexibility to make reasonable and still principled compromise in the interests of the country. And I think it's largely attitude. I was the Democratic leader of the Senate, so I had two constituencies, my Democratic colleagues who elected me and the Senate. Bob Dole had the same thing on his side, but we both recognized that we had a larger and a higher obligation, and it is to the country and to the institution of the Senate. And so you have to get kind of straight in your own mind what your real priorities are and where your ultimate obligations lie.
Now, Senator Mitchell, maybe we can pivot to talk more about the Northern Ireland peace process. Here was divisions that existed for a very long time. People believed them to be intractable. Could you point to one or two moments during those negotiations? You were involved for 5 years that marked a kind of breakthrough and helped us get to where we are today?
There was one moment. After about 2.5 years of almost abject failure, and literally I was called a failure every day by the press. When are you leaving, Senator? You failed here. That sort of thing. We experienced an upsurge in violence. There'd been a killing, and that led to a counter-killing and a series of assassinations and bombings. Broke the ceasefire, the tentative ceasefire, and endangered the whole society by a possible return to the bitterness of the conflict. And I decided that the process was going to fail. I then came up with the idea of a firm, unbreakable deadline. I didn't have the authority to impose it. So I went around. There were 10 Northern Ireland political parties, plus the governments of Britain and Ireland. So there were 12 parties in the talks. I went one by one to try to talk them into letting me establish a deadline. And when finally, after a month of the most incredible haggling, I was able to get them to agree, that was the first glimmer. Because any one of them could have refused to permit a deadline, and I think the process would have therefore spiraled into outright conflict in a very short time. But the fact that they were willing to commit to a deadline, to me, was a signal they wanted to get this over with. And that was the first time I had a real glimmer of hope in the process, and just a few months later we ended up with an agreement.
But that process, which was, as you say, you had to do with each individual person, and you brought to bear there the values that you identify in the book, listening and patience, a good sense of timing, a willingness to take risks. But they all have to be personalized, don't they, within a personal relationship. I was speaking with somebody who works at the United Nations the other day, and he is involved in this, you know, the effort of he was in some way involved in the talks with the Iranians. And he said, you know, when people would ask me, how do you negotiate with the Iranians? He'd say, you don't. You actually negotiate with the Iranian across the table from you. It has that personal element. Would you agree?
Oh, yes. It's very important. And I think, although obvious, is largely understated and not well understood. To take an area that you haven't mentioned, the Middle East, I said in my book that I think ultimately the Israelis and Palestinians will come around to reaching an agreement because it is so much in the interest of both societies that they'll overcome the hurdles. But one of the hurdles that they now face is the tremendously high level of mistrust between their leaders. Prime Minister Netanyahu does not believe that President Abbas has the strength, personal or political, to reach and enforce an agreement. And so, since he thinks it's going to fail, he's unwilling to take substantial risks and open himself to sharp criticism with his own society, which is divided. On the other side, President Abbas does not believe that Prime Minister Netanyahu is serious about getting an agreement. He thinks he doesn't have any intention of ever reaching an agreement, and he does only enough to satisfy the United States. He thinks it's going to fail, and therefore he's unwilling to take any risk that would expose him to criticism in his society. And that lack of trust, that lack of belief in the sincerity and seriousness of purpose of the person with whom you must deal, dooms the process to failure at the outset. And so there has to be at least a minimum level of trust that the other person really is seeking the ultimate objective, in this case a peace agreement, before you can begin to get movement on the very, very tough issues that are involved.
So I wonder whether, you know, it's interesting, we should talk about these two things in relation to one another, in some sense, the Middle East and Northern Ireland. In Northern Ireland, you had Protestants and Catholics who had this, you know, a deep history of division and violence and distrust and all the rest. But at some fundamental level, they were both Christians. And I wonder if that, you know, rather than say, I mean, in the Middle East, where you might have a similar kind of history, you know, you have people who belong to totally different faith traditions. So was that a factor at all in the outcome in Northern Ireland?
Yeah, I don't know that, Father. I can't say that. First off, as I've said recently, I didn't say this in my book, I did a separate presentation on this subject recently, that, you know, that conflict was, of course, affected by and infused by religion, as are the conflicts in the Middle East. But it's not purely that. Throughout history, men mostly, but women also, have sought political leadership using religion as a tool for political power. Mm-hmm. Don't know that. People proclaim values that they may not share or not themselves practice, but just because they think it's a way to help them get votes or to gain power in some other way. And so, I wouldn't want to judge each individual with whom I dealt in terms of how much was real and how much was so-called put on, but that's true worldwide. I can't say for sure, but the way you presented it does sound plausible and logical, although I can tell you that the hostility between the two sides of Northern Ireland was very real and very deep and led to extraordinary depths of brutality. You know, the car bomb was invented in Northern Ireland.
Right,
It's kind of a tragic legacy of their history.
Now, one of the themes in the book that you come back to is what does it mean to be an American? I wonder if you can speak to that, and also what you think about what it means to be a Catholic American living today.
Yeah, well, I think, first off, I'm so fortunate. My mother was born in Lebanon. My father's parents were born in Ireland. There was a large, huge amount of chance and fate that brought them not just to this country, but my parents to end up living in houses next door to one another in a slum in a small town in Maine, and I being the product of that. I mean, I could just as easily have been born somewhere in the west of Ireland or in the mountains of Lebanon or someplace else, and I think clearly I would have led a much different life and most likely a much lesser life than I have, so I think of myself as extremely, very, very, very lucky. Secondly, one of the lessons that my parents taught us, not so much by words, my father was not much of a talker. He wasn't an eloquent spokesman, but that meant when he did speak, we listened, and my mother, of course, lived it by example, was that my father and I rarely had what you'd call father and son conversations. But I remember with absolute clarity when I left home to go to college. I had just turned 17. I'd hardly ever been anywhere. My parents didn't own a car. I had to hitchhike to college. He said to me, he said, "You're a smart kid." He said, "You're going to do well." He said, "Don't you ever forget where you came from." He said, "Look over there. Look at your mother. Look at me." And it made a profound impression on me. You know, don't forget where you came from. Don't judge others. Don't be negatively judgmental about others, and do the best you can. And that did have an effect on me. And as I said earlier, and I repeat, my mother was profoundly religious. I mean, she went to Mass every day. She prayed every day. She believed, I told a story in the book, that no person could enter a house, nobody, without having a full meal. My mother wouldn't tolerate it, wouldn't permit it. You had to eat. And I told a story about the plumber who once came, he said, I can't eat. I just had lunch. My mother said, "You eat." And then the plumber later said, "I never made that mistake again. I just before lunch or just before supper." So I think, I understand, I don't want to politicize this, I understand that there are people who cheat and people who game the system and so forth, but I tell you, from my own experience, I told a story in my book about how my father was out of work for 1 year, my senior year in high school, and it was absolutely devastating. And I believe the vast majority of people in our country want to do better, want to work. They're distraught. They lose self-esteem. We don't keep in mind enough what a critical factor to every human being's development and enjoyment is: a sense of self-esteem, a sense of self-worth, a sense of being a participating and contributing member in some kind of a community, a family, a town, a neighborhood, political party, some organization that gives them and enhances their sense of self-worth and meaning. And I believe that's what I learned from my father and from my upbringing. I attended a parochial school for the first 6 years of my life. I was taught by Ursuline nuns, just a wonderful, wonderful order of women based originally in Eastern Canada, and they still are involved in education, and at least in some parts of the northeastern United States. And I think it's made me what I am.
Well, amen to that. The book is The Negotiator, Reflections on an American Life, from Maine to the U.S. Senate, from baseball to Disney, from Northern Ireland to the Middle East, and it is available wherever books are sold. Senator Mitchell, thank you very much for being our guest today, and thank you for your service to our country.
Thank you for having me, Father.
All right, God bless. When we come back, we're going to talk with Becca Stevens, the author of a new book, Letters from the Farm, A Simple Path for a Deeper Spiritual Life. Stay with us on America This Week on Sirius XM 129.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.